uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight. And into the late night moonbat hour. So we appreciate you being with us and staying up with us as per usual. And we're going to be getting into all kinds of news and information for you on the show tonight and our continued series of reading we started the other night as well. The book with the long ass title that I can't remember off the top of my head. That's pretty much how we tell the truth on that one right there. Yeah, the long-ass book with the title I don't remember. Yeah, C.W. Ledbetter, The Astral Plane, Its Scenery, Inhabitants, and Phenomenon. So if we have time, we'll pick up there tonight. We have, I don't know if we have any emails, but we always love to have emails as well if you want to send those in during the show, after the show, anytime you want to send those in to me. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. Sorry, I'm just adjusting my mic here. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. And that's where you send stuff to ask me questions about info or comments about the show or anything else. That's how you do it. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. Sounds different. EQ levels or something. Yeah, I mean, like I said, dude, I've been messing with this thing. The EQ levels and everything have been messed with since the last show. I mean, not since the last show, but since before the last show. No cat sabotage. Maybe you didn't hear the last show. I've got a new preamp recently. I'm trying a different microphone, so the different microphone I'm using probably gives you the appearance that it's some kind of different EQ levels. Does it sound terrible? Does it sound bad? I mean, is it a problem? So it sounds fine. Okay, so my website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. It's www.theglobalreality.com. It's where you find all the information pertaining to my work up there, the stream, the archives, documentaries, the tab to buy Secret Right Volume 2 on Blu-ray, on DVD, books, audio stuff up there, chat room links, everything's up there at the website, as well as the ways to support our work and what we're doing here, because we can't survive and do all the work we need to do without the wonderful help of our listening audience. And we thank everybody out there who does help us. And it helps us keep going. We have the blue chipping banner that's for the bills for the month. And we have the silver one, which is for the first budget for the Rockwall film shooting that I'll be doing next week. And we also have a one-time donation button there. We also have a monthly subscription where you can select an amount that will come out of your account monthly, so you don't have to come and visit a chipping banner or something like that every month. We have a few people who do a $20, but there are amounts that go on up. We've never had anybody go higher than that, but it is there, and you can put in your own amount. And we also have a P.O. Box address if you absolutely positively can't pay online, which is what we prefer. So there you go. Please support our work if you can. Let me see if I have any emails tonight. Here's an email from Jim. I am going Peter Rabbit. What the fuck does that mean? Hey, why doesn't your chat room work, man? Is this a demo crazy? Where I, as a listener, have a voice. What the fuck does that mean? Well, first, learn how to formulate complete sentences when use proper wording and the proper usage of words and all that stuff. And once you're able to master that and master sending a coherent email without going off about Peter Rabbit, then we might be able to graduate you into being able to chat in the chat room. But until then, oh, man, you get some great emails. Let's see what else we have. Somebody the other night said, Josh, I think you missed it. The rocket spraying clouds in the upper atmosphere is a beta test for the release of a DNA-changing bioweapon that eugenicists want to release. Okay, well, I'd love to see your documentation on that. I'd love to see your proof of that. How can you say that I missed something if I don't? I mean, yeah, that crossed my mind when I read that article, but I didn't come out right out and say that. And the reason I didn't come right out and say this is because there's no way I can prove that. I don't get into the business of just getting up here. And I mean, if I'm going to speculate about something, I'll tell you this is just pure speculation, or I'm just theorizing. And when I'm doing that, you will be well aware that that's what I'm doing, because I will say it beforehand. That's what I've always done on this show. And, you know, that very well may be a real possibility. But without proof and without a way to really say that's what that is, because I've heard that that would be impossible, that it's impossible for them to be able to apparently they could spray anthrax and Ebola and everything out of airplanes for weeks and weeks and days and dump it over population areas, and it wouldn't be very effective, because it dissipates. That's why they've always used the chaff in the chemtrail operations, because what the chaff does is the chaff gives them the ability to be able to pull down things that are already up in the atmosphere, and then we breathe them in, and it goes through the blood-brain barrier, and there's all kinds of nastiness up there in the atmosphere that they're able to access and bring down to the ground. So, no, I didn't miss that that was a possibility. I just don't get up here and say, folks, these rocket clouds are spraying clouds in the upper atmosphere. It's a beta test for DNA-changing bioweapon eugenicists want to release. I mean, literally, that sounds, what you sent me, I mean, that one line, it sounds like something straight out of the Alex Jones show or Alex Jones playbook. It just sounds like some classic Jones fear sauce. I mean, it literally does. Let me read it for you again. Folks, the rocket spraying clouds in the upper atmosphere, it's a beta test for the release of a DNA-changing bioweapon the eugenicists want to release. I mean, it just sounds like straight out of his playbook. So, again, whether that may be true or not, unless you have hard physical evidence to prove it, it's not really, I mean, you're just adding fuel to a fire that's already being fanned by all kinds of exaggerations. And you have to be vigilant in this information and be careful, you know, what you grab onto. Just because we get into stuff that is different from the mainstream, it doesn't mean we fall for every little bullshit thing that comes out. You know what I mean? You got to be careful about that. This is from Renio Ferguson. He says, "Hey Josh, I heard you mention Robotech, which I was a huge fan of, so I started to think of other programs I watched when I was young, and I thought of Moonbase Alpha, which sounds more like Moonbase Nibiru, which was NASA trying to tell us something." Yeah, I haven't heard of that one, but I'll definitely have to check that out. This is from Nick Spiro. He says, was just watching the old film with Robin Williams, Popeye. I decided to scan all the credits at the end of the film. I compared Jewish names versus Italian or Latin names. There was a good mix of both, but to my surprise, I discovered that the movie was filmed in Malta. Nice tidbit, I guess. There is so much more of Malta that is never shown to the public. There has to be something so profound about Malta that it's more secretive than ancient Egypt. Well, it is, and there is what's there. What I found, Nick, is what is there is has so many similarities that I've found now between it and Rockwall that it's astounding. And they film many movies there on the island of Malta. There's the famous scene. I can't remember what James Bond movies that was in, but there's the James Bond movies. I think it was the James Bond hideout or something where it was on that little island and it opened up and the boat came out from this like concrete thing inside of the island. Well, that's the island of Malta where the James Bond headquarters thing was at. And there's an ancient civilization on there. There's tracks on that island that appear to be like, the grooves like you see in an aircraft carrier for takeoff and landing and stuff like that. They found, a few months ago, they found a piece, I think it was a piece of agate, some kind of shell. We put it up on the website. It's probably still in my news archive somewhere. I'd posted it on Facebook and a bunch of places. But it was a stone that had these hieroglyphics or some sort of etchings on them. And they looked very similar to some of the stones that had been found. The big 2.5-ton garnet stones that CMP member of Freemason Ralph Hall supposedly has in his possession. And so that was the first thing, and then the how old it is. It's much older than anything else found on Earth. It's very, very old. And then last week we had that story about that temple there on Malta where, where it resonates and has frequencies and sound that respond to, vibrations and energies. I'm definitely going to be showcasing some of the similarities between the things that are on the island of Malta and the rock wall in the rock wall film, Nick. So thanks so much for bringing that up. I think that's all the emails we have. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com is my email address. If you ever want to send in more emails, that's where you do it at. In this weekly series, Life's Little Mysteries, Life's Little Mysteries rates the plausibility of popular science fiction concepts. Science fiction or fact, E.T. will look like us. From the Klingons in Star Trek to the skinny, oval-eyed creatures in classic alien abduction tales, many depictions of extraterrestrials in popular culture have been decidedly human-like in sci-fi movies and TV. The reason is obvious. Makeup is much less expensive for a humanoid alien, and it's tough to act in a giant ooze suit. Plus, it's much easier to empathize with beings that look like us, so it is no accident that evil aliens oftentimes ooze mucus and sport tentacles. These narrative considerations aside, what is the likelihood that intelligent alien life, if we ever discover it, will actually resemble humankind? It's more programming, getting us ready for this, for the alien rollout here. Scientists have actually proposed solid arguments for and against ET developing a body plan similar to ours. At face value, if you will, it seems unlikely that organisms on another world that underwent eons of unique evolutionary history should fit comfortably in our clothes. Why should they look like us? No other creatures look that much like us except for other apes. An alien will look like whatever its evolutionary niche is. But maybe that's just it. Perhaps evolutionary circumstances, similar to those that led us to develop limbs and fingers to manipulate tools, arose on alien planets. Maybe being bipeds with bilateral symmetry is a prerequisite for building socially and technologically advanced societies. And this is what this is as well. The reason they're bringing this up, I think, is they're trying to scientifically look at the likelihood of what something like this would look like from another planet, so that when they get ready to fake something, they may have more of an opportunity to be able to make something more believable. You know what I mean? So as far as we know, to develop complexity, life requires environmental conditions very similar to those on Earth over the last several 100 million years. And to get going in the first place, life almost certainly needs water. That is why the ongoing hunt for alien life in the cosmos is focused on finding water. And this is still, you know, they're still looking for the wrong things. I mean, again, still looking at I mean, we found organisms living in, all kinds of deadly poisons and all kinds of stuff where, you would think would be barren of life. And life just thrives there. So that's, again, that's the thing that we're missing in all of this, and science continues to miss, I think, by design, is that we have no reference point, no frame of reference for what forms consciousness will take on outside of our own. That's why when you see these depictions of, like, the Anunnaki, and they look at these bird-like creatures and all these dog-headed creatures and stuff in Egyptian stuff, and people just say, oh, well, that's just symbology, and that's the way they're representing this. And I believe it's possible that couldn't be the case. I believe it's not the case. I don't believe that it is symbology. I believe that it's consciousness, consciousness taking on forms that are different to us but still plausible. I mean, it's very plausible that there were quote-unquote intelligent beings that looked like, dogs walking around upright or big eagles or birds. I mean, it's very possible. But I love how that even being a possibility is not even entered into the argument when discussing, what aliens or extraterrestrials could possibly look like. Rare animal-shaped mounds discovered in Peru. This is an interesting article sent to us by a listener. For more than a century and a half, scientists and tourists have visited massive animal-shaped mounds such as Serpent Mound in Ohio, created by the indigenous people of North America. But few animal effigy mounds had been found in South America until University of Missouri anthropology professor emeritus Robert Benfer identified numerous earthen animals rising from above the coastal plains of Peru, a region already renowned for the Nazca Lines, the ruined city of Chan Chan, and other cultural treasures. The mounds will draw tourists one day, Benfer said. Some of them are more than 4,000 years old. Compare that to the effigy mounds of North America, which date between 400 and 1200 AD. The oldest Peruvian mounds were built at the same time as the pyramids in Egypt. Knocked something off my desk. I don't know what it was. Well, I guess if it's important, I'll find it later. Benfer identified the mounds, which range from 5 meters, 16.5 feet, to 1,312 feet long in each of the six valleys he surveyed in coastal Peru. The mounds predate ceramics and were probably built using woven baskets to carry and pile up soil and rock. Like the Nazca lines, which include a series of giant animal outlines drawn on the ground to the south, the animal mounds were best observed from a higher vantage point. Google Earth images of the mounds revealed that the shapes of birds, including a giant condor, a 5,000-year-old orca, a duck, and a caiman puma monster seen in bone and rock carvings from the area, the finding of the animal effigy mounds, where there were none before, changes our conception of early Peruvian prehistory, Benfer said, that they probably represent the Andean zodiac. It's also a new find. Well, that's interesting in and of itself. It's some sort of Andes mountain, you know, version of Peru of the zodiac. That would go right in line with what the Sumerian texts talk about, because that area was, you know, the landing place and all that stuff. Benfer suggests the structures may have been built as terrestrial manifestations of constellations the ancient Peruvians saw in the stars above. The mounds only represented the stars, they aligned with them. So far, Benfer has found astronomical orientations at every giant mound. For example, at the Chalon Valley site, an earthen condor's charcoal eye lined up with the Milky Way when viewed from a nearby temple. The monstrous Caima Puma mound aligned with the June summer solstice when viewed from the same temple. The monster, I read that already. According to Benfer, astronomer priests may have made directed construction of the mounds and then made observations for the sky and offerings to Earth from atop the earthen creatures. For the ancients, having a celestial calendar allowed farmers and fishermen to prepare for the year ahead. Well, see, I think that's what we were just talking about here with these, here we go. You know, here's animal things that are aligned to zodiacal and sites and signs and located to different planetary systems, and they're animals that represent these things. And here they are again giving us that old line of, you know, well, this has to do with these are offerings, and these have to do with animals and floods. Well, no. What if it has to do with these quote-unquote gods who had consciousness and great power and technology but took on the shapes and forms of animals, and then these animal stones were aligned to the location that they traveled back to, some planet that goes around the star system? We find that more and more, that all these ancient sites are all aligned to different... People always get hung up on the Sirius thing, and Sirius is important to the elite and to the secret societies, but... not every single one of the things are always aligned to Sirius. Oftentimes they are, but they're also aligned. Their things are aligned to all kinds of different things. I mean, finding out that the stuff about Cygnus and how, you know, that's actually seems to be more important than even Sirius is. It's kind of crazy. But we see this many examples of this, many alignments, and it seems as if that's what these people who were setting themselves up as gods were doing. They were, you know, assigned to a planetary system where they lived, and they traveled between a stargate from here to there, and then made their monuments aligned to these different planetary and star systems so that their cults and religions could be built around them for their prophesized returns. So definitely a interesting article there. I'll drop it in the chat room for you. I thought this was just brilliant. After all the uproar about the pink slime lately, who do they send out to get the thumbs up about it? None other than Bilderberg Group member Rick Perry, the wonderful governor down here in Texas where I live. You know what I mean? It's like all this uproar, and who do they get to say it's, oh, it's beef, man. It's all good. Don't worry about it. I mean, come on. That makes you definitely know you shouldn't be eating it. Governors from three meat-producing states today defended Beef Products Incorporated, the company that makes lean, finely textured beef, which now former USDA scientist nicknamed Pink Slime. After a walk through the company's plant accompanied by ABC News, let's call this product what it is and let pink slime become a term of the past, Texas Governor Rick Perry said after the tour, after which officials showed off T-shirts with the slogan, "Dude, it's beef." I mean, give me a break. What an operation here. That tells you who owns all these beef processing plants, who has money in it. You know, all people who are Bilderberg Group members, you know, that's who owns these things. That's who's putting this. Otherwise, they wouldn't be sending people like Rick Perry out for these, you know, PR appearances. Stung by consumer reaction to the process used by BPI grocery stores pulled beef containing the filler off the shelves, and BPI closed three of its four plants for lack of demand. The governor said that the treatment of the products received in the media was unfair because it is not only safe, but also nutritious and allows grocers to sell leaner ground beef at a lower cost. So it's nutritious. That ammonia is nutritious for you. Yes. I mean, that's what your forefathers, when they, back in the day when everybody had to kill their own food, that's what they did, right? That's what they looked for, yeah. They looked for the amount of ammonia that meat had in it before they killed it out on the open plain and cooked it there. Yeah, that's what they wanted. I mean, God damn. I mean, Soylent Green is good for you. Here, eat it. It's Soylent Green. It's great. But it's people. Yeah, but it tastes so good. Eat it. It's beef, but it's leaner beef, which is better for you. See, it's leaner because we take all these little bits and pieces off the chopping room floor, cutting room floor. And we pack it all down into a big fucking brick. Bones and fucking, you know, nuts and balls and everything and fucking grind it all up. And then they put it in a thing and they spin it around till all the fat spins off of it. And then they chip that shit off in big old fucking bricks. And just sell it. It's good. It's meat. I'll eat it. I'm Rick Perry. I'll eat this shit raw. Woo! God damn. I mean, couldn't you get somebody better than that for your PR campaign, please? The Department of Homeland Security is buying 450 million hollow point bullets. I got a question. I'm kind of curious about something. What in the fuck? What in the name of
Satan's cock
do they need 450 million hollow point bullets for? I mean, what the fuck are these guys planning? It's hard to think that there isn't something big coming around the corner like a civil war. I think this Trayvon thing is, especially if there turns out to be a trial and they actually do arrest this guy and he gets off because he will. You know, there's all kinds of things that could spark off really soon, and it just seems interesting to me. They're buying 450 million rounds. That's almost one round for every person in the United States of America. Well, we're a little over, what, 500 million now in this country? Somewhere in there, over that, maybe 600 million, close to that. So still almost one bullet for every single citizen of the United States. That's a scary little number there, isn't it? Close to 500 million people in this country. Department of Homeland Security is just conveniently buying close to 500 million hollow point bullets. I mean, I don't know if I like those numbers too much. The Department of Homeland Security and its Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office is getting an indefinite delivery of an indefinite quantity of 40 caliber ammunition from defense contractor ATK. U.S. agents will receive a maximum of 450 million rounds over 5 years, according to a press release on the deal. The high-performance HST bullets are designed for law enforcement, and ATK says they offer optimum penetration for terminal performance. That's a great fucking military tactic term right there, isn't it? Optimum penetration for terminal performance. I mean, these guys, it's all, I mean, George Carlin was right years ago when he said, you know, all wars are based on the sizes of dicks, and the bombs and the bullets and the rockets are all shaped like dicks. What, they have bigger dicks? Bomb them. You know, he was right about that. Optimum penetration.
Optimum penetration for terminal performance. Oh yeah, that's what Satan likes. Optimum penetration, baby.
Optimum penetration, so the maximum amount of penetration you can get for terminal performance. What does terminal performance mean? Oh, performance to make you terminal, to make you dead. I get it. Wow, what a sell point. These bullets kill you. They're better than the other guys. Well, what makes your bullets better than this guy over here? These kill people. Well, these bullets kill people too, right? Yeah, but these have optimum penetration for terminal performance. Our bullets are better than this guy's because ours kill people better. Yeah, but don't those bullets kill people too? Yeah, but ours kill them better. I just love it. It's a bullet, dude. It's all about where you put it anyway. I think this is telling us that the Homeland Security, the people here they're getting in Homeland Security are getting worse and worse and worse at shooting things. I mean, these guys aren't fucking marksmen. They're not shooters. They're just fucking spray gun pilots, dude. They're just going and fucking spraying rounds. It doesn't take any skill. They know how to do double taps because they've been playing fucking first-person shooters for decades. Oh, this is rich. You know, we know that Al Qaeda and the Taliban are all intelligence operative created, but you know, I knew this would come eventually because, well, frankly, these queens just can't put it away. You know, I've wondered how they've been dealing with this. You know, with all that time, with all these guys spending all that time in, you know, Taliban operations and, you know, CIA stuff and Al-Qaeda operations. I've been wondering how these, you know, these closet queens have been keeping it under wraps. Well, it appears that it's under wraps no longer. Meet the Taliban transvestites. You can't make this kind of stuff up, folks. You just can't. Rebels are captured dressed in drag. U.S. military commanders in Afghanistan have assigned guardian angels, troops to watch over their comrades even as they sleep, as part of a series of increased security measures to protect troops against possible rogue attacks. The added protections are part of a directive issued in recent weeks by Marine General John Allen to the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan to guard against insider threats, as they come in the wake of a spike in attack on U.S. coalition forces by Afghans, including the point-blank shooting deaths of two U.S. advisors in Afghan's military Ministry of Interior. The lengths the Taliban are prepared to go in order to gain access to coalition forces was illustrated yesterday when local police arrested seven men dressed in women's clothing in the Metaram Langham province east of Kabul. I don't believe this for a second. I think these guys, these Blackwater guys, who are jonesing for a fucking, you know, for a stroll down the Hershey Highway, have been in country too long. I think these guys captured a bunch of goat herders, dressed them up in women's clothes, cornholed the ever-living dog piss out of them, and then when they got done with them, jizzed all over them, picked them up and took them outside and said, look, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, we caught them. If you ever tell anybody I cornholed you, boy, I'll put a bullet in your head, eh, Rabber? Goddamn sand coon. I'll put a goddamn bullet in your head if you ever tell anybody I fucked you in the ass. I really think that's what's going on here. I think they dress these fucking, they cornhole these fucking goat farmers and They were trying to cover it up for it, make it look like they got a nice, you know, Taliban score at the same time, right? Kill two birds with one stone, or get two birds stoned at once, as Ricky from Trailer Park Boys would say. I mean, it's a win-win. I mean, look at this. Look, I'm not buying this. Look at these guys here. This one, you know, they really liked because he kind of looks like Jesus. And as I said, you know, these are like Blackwater and, you know, these right-wing closet homos. But look at that guy. You know, these guys double-teamed him. That's why they're both got an arm around him. Like, oh, yes, this was Jesus. We made him do us missionary style for a very long time. Then we brought his queer ass out and told him everybody was Taliban. Yay, we're heroes. America! Fuck yeah! That is primetime America right there for you. Speaking of that, I love how the whole TSA thing. I love how the scourge of America has been hired to do that job, and it wasn't enough with all the "don't touch my junk, dude" stuff that was going on, and I mean now it's the laundry list of things TSA workers have been busted for now is just insane. TSA manager arrested for running prostitution ring. That's always nice. A manager of the Transportation Security Administration has lost his job after being arrested on prostitution-related charges, according to court documents. The agency had received a complaint of very similar activities back in 2009. Bryant Jermaine Livingston, 39, was arrested while on the job as a supervisor of TSA agents at Dulles International Airport. The Manassas, Virginia resident said by phone he is innocent of the charges, but declined to discuss the details of the case. According to charging documents, on February 15th, Livingston used cash to rent a room at the Crown Plaza Hotel on Georgia Avenue in Silver Spring, Maryland. The hotel manager recognized Livingston as a previous customer who, on earlier occasions, had groups of males and females frequently entering and exiting Livingston's room. Similar activity was happening on February 15th, so the manager called Montgomery County Police to report likely prostitution. So he's running hoes. He's TSA. That's good quality. Then this other guy gets busted with child porn. Remember the guy that told the woman that he made her think she had coke, pulled a white baggie of stuff out of her purse, made her pee herself crying, "You're going to jail. You're going to jail, bitch. Goddamn right. Oh, I'm just fucking with you. I put that there." He wasn't even reprimanded for it. A former employee of the U.S. Transportation Security Administration has been sentenced to nearly 3.5 years in prison for possession of child pornography. He's probably sitting there fucking cranking one out. "Oh, I'll watch the monitor today, Steve." "Yeah. No, you go ahead and go out there and feel the junk and fill up some boobs and a breast for me and an 8-year-old. I mean a meal for a nice looking woman. I'm gonna stay in here and watch the screens. I'll let you know if we need to get anybody to go through more than once or 8 or 10 times so I can see their little girl and little boy asses. I'm looking for MILFs and cougars. Just go in there, Steve. I'll watch the cameras. Don't worry about me. I've got this." Oh, man. If you haven't seen the there's a South Park, I think it was the first episode of this, of the new season, the Toilet Security Administration. One of the characters' moms gets her, is this whole thing about leaving the toilet seat up, you know, guys leaving the toilet seat up. And I agree with my whole point on that is, why can't you just look before you sit down? We don't want to, we sit down and we fall and we get our ass wet. Well, why don't you look before you sit down, bitch? Simple fucking shit to me. And she gets her guts sucked out and dies. And so to stop people's deaths from leaving the toilet seat up, they have the TSA, the Toilet Security Administration, and they install seat belts and cameras in everybody's house. And they got guys watching camera banks for hours and hours jerking off while you're dropping a deuce. Oh, man. It's funny shit. Algorithm captures what sounds most pleasing to the ear, and it could put human instrument tuners out of a job. New findings from a German scientist may be music to a musician's ears, but it could put those high-priced human tuners out of business. Hey Henriksen of the University of Wurzburg has found a formula that can tune an instrument based on what is pleasing to the human ear. While handheld digital devices can tune musical instruments such as guitars, such tuners are not as effective with pianos and harpsichords. As Henriksen writes, the instrument as a whole will eventually sound as if it was out of tune, even though each individual key is tuned to the correct frequency. In deciphering Henriksen's work, the MIT Technology Review Physics blog reports that the sound of individual strings is the result of its fundamental frequency and its harmonics at frequencies that are a whole number or multiples of that fundamental. Oh, the golden ratio. The golden number. Oh, so imagine that. So you start to get perfect tuning whenever you when individual strings vibrate and resonate through the different multiples of the fundamental number of the golden ratio. Well, hello. That's what, you know, all the great classical composers who were all in, you know, secret societies or all Freemasons and stuff, that's what they all knew. That's what those things, that's what the secret sciences of the secret societies, Freemasons, have, that's one of the things they teach you. How each note has a vibration and a frequency and things that connect to it. That's what all the great classical composers knew, and that's what the great, you know, songwriters of our day, very few of them that there are, know how to use as well. They know how to use the frequencies that affect not only the conscious mind, but the subconscious mind of the listener as well. It's an ancient occult art. So not a surprise to see they're unlocking that with today's technology. Not a real surprise here. Another verification of things we already know. I've been saying for years, ever since we started hearing about the honeybee issue, that, you know, Monsanto 100% all the way across the board, and they've come up with every other kind of excuse and reason behind it, but they're coming back now with more information. Dramatic decline of bees caused by modern pesticides damaging their ability to home in on their hives, say researchers. Pesticides introduced in the 1990s are to blame, of course. I bet it's Roundup and every other kind of Monsanto garbage you can name. Bees are in dramatic decline, and scientists believe the answer may be in their homing instinct. They found the latest generation of pesticides is stopping the foragers finding their way back to the hive. French researchers tagged 650 honeybees with tiny microchips attached to their necks, which tracked all their movements. Half the bees were exposed to low doses of insecticides, similar to what they would find in the wild. And when released, these ones were found to be two or three times more likely to die away from their hive. So again, probably still won't change anything. I mean, it doesn't matter how much proof they have. Monsanto has completely bought everybody out. And they bought everybody's silence, and they bought everybody's acquiescence. I mean, it's just the way it is. Former nuclear scientist at Large Hadron Collider goes on trial accused of being an Al-Qaeda agent. Now, this is very interesting here. It makes you wonder if they were planning some kind of inside job type of event with the LHC. A nuclear scientist has gone on trial for allegedly plotting terror attacks with the North African wing of Al-Qaeda. Magistrates investigating the case of the emails Adeline Hitchour exchanged with suspected Islamists crossed the line of simple debate of political or religious ideas to enter the sphere of terrorist violence. However, his lawyers told the court that while their client had sent angry emails, he never took any steps towards committing to an attack. They said there was no proof of any terrorist intention. So, the more that I read about this, though, it does sound like this guy could very well be being set up. Like, he found something out or something was discovered, and he was getting ready to go public with something they found at the LHC, and they said, hey, you know what? Fuck you. We're going to make everybody think you're Al-Qaeda. So it definitely, if you read the article, it definitely does give you that impression. Osama bin Laden initially dismissed the prospect of a 9/11-style plot against America as inconsequential. So a further unraveling of the already torn to shreds narrative of they hate us for our freedoms. They attacked us for our freedoms. Osama bin Laden initially dismissed the prospect of a 9/11 style plot against America as inconsequential, according to a new book. When the strike was first proposed to him in 1996, the al-Qaeda leader was noncommittal and refused to give his backing. It was not until three years later before he could be brought around, and another 5 years before the deadliest attacks on U.S. soil since Pearl Harbor eventually took place. And, come on. We know what he was. He was a patsy. He was the boogeyman. He was the guy they set up. He was long dead before they ever started pinning stuff on him, but they'd been setting him up for years, and, you know, he's off somewhere sipping martinis on a beach. Fossil foot from Ethiopia is a new species of pre-human and will help scientists home in on the moment our ancestors descended from the trees. A fossilized foot for the mysterious new species of human that walked the earth 3 million years ago could offer insight to how man evolved to walk on 2 feet. And the partial remains from nothing suggests more than one type of hominin may have existed between 3 or 4 million years ago. Although the new hominin would have walked upright, it also had grasping feet used for climbing trees. The creature came to light when an international team of researchers unearthed a partial foot in eastern Africa. Like the more famous Lucy skeleton, it walked upright but had a grasping foot that it used to climb tree branches. Scientists said it is now clear that various human relatives experimented with upright walking. So it was some kind of chimp-human thing that was probably, you know, a good candidate for genetic manipulation, sounds like to me. The key to a cure for obesity might lurk in an unlikely place, in the bowels of mummified corpses from 3,000 years ago. Scientists believe that one of the causes of today's obesity... I just saw a mistake in the last article. Couldn't even read. In this one, may be the cause of today's obesity epidemic. I think they meant to say epidemic. I mean, does nobody proofread anything anymore before it goes to press? I mean, I see mistaken words in news stories almost every single day, but I see them in books and I see them in textbooks and all kinds of places. Have we just gotten that dumb? Or is it that they just know that most people don't read this shit anyway, they don't even care? The cause of today's obesity academic? No, obesity epidemic, retards. Scientists believe that one of the causes of today's obesity academic may be antibiotics, which have changed humanity's gut flora, the bacteria that live inside of us. Researchers believe that a possible cure for obesity might be to repopulate our guts with ancient bacterium from a time before antibiotics existed. I mean, this anybody else from me get the sneaking suspicion that this sounds like, here, now, Perplexia, the cure for obesity. One pill, one shot, one time, here you go. Obesity is now a thing of a past. Extracted from the mummified corpses of 3,000-year-old mummies and brought straight to you from Pfizer. Side effects include black plague, scarlet fever, the funk of 40,000 years. I mean, literally. What was it? Side effects may include, you know, the black plague. I mean, I don't know about that. Let's, I don't know about putting, you know, I think the problem is that we're jacking everything full of poison. And it's very difficult and becoming increasingly difficult for your average person like you and I to get food that's not jacked full of crap. And, I mean, that's the problem. That's where we need to look for solutions. Where no man has gone before, scientists developed sat-nav for spaceships, which could pave man's way beyond the solar system. You just got to get past that pesky Van Allen radiation built a theoretical barrier around the Earth first, though, don't you? Nobody wants to talk about that. Satellite navigation systems don't work in space. The satellites in question are far away, orbiting one tiny planet called Earth. But scientists think they may have cracked a new system for navigation in deep space using pulsars as beacons to guide spaceships through the stars. The system is reminiscent of sailors steering using the stars and the moon, but using neutron stars to set a course precisely through the universe. The new system would use X-ray light from pulsars to triangulate a position in space and works everywhere in the universe to within a few miles. When stars much more massive than our own sun reach the end of their lives, their final demise is marked by a dramatic supernova explosion that destroys most of the star. But many leave behind compact, incredibly dense remnants known as neutron stars. Those detected have strong magnetic fields that focus emissions into two tightly directional beams. The neutron star rotates rapidly, and if the beam points in the direction of the Earth, we see a pulse of radiation at extremely regular intervals, hence the name pulsar. A team from Germany's Max Planck Institute are developing a navigation technology for spacecraft based on the regular emission of X-ray light from pulsars. Their periodic signals have timing stabilities comparable to atomic clocks and provide characteristic time signatures that can be used as a natural navigation beacon, similar to the use of GPS satellites for navigation on Earth. So, just kind of like the Enterprise uses there. So, they're getting ready to go somewhere, aren't they? They're getting ready to try and get out there into space for some reason. Of course, we know why that is. Go to these other planets like Titan, or these moons like Titan, and mine for resources and oil and whatever else, and bring back to Earth tax-free and extend their petroleum-based economy even farther into the future. We're going to take a break, come back, and continue our series of reading that we started the other night. I think this is going to be a good read, and can't wait to get into with you here throughout the coming days over the show. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. It's TheGlobalReality.com. And we have our fundraiser for going on this week to pay the bills of the month, and Matt is coming up. The shipping banner ends on Saturday, and we need to meet that goal there, so please help us out with that if you can. Take a break, come back, get into more, folks. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
Have mercy.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. We're going to be getting into our series of reading in this segment of the broadcast, The Astral Plane, Its Scenery, Inhabitants, and Phenomenon. We were starting a segment entitled Scenery last time, so we'll be starting there tonight. TheGlobalReality.com, again, is my website. That's where you find everything pertaining to my work. You can get all my documentary films up there. Somebody has had sent me a message saying it's not really apparent where to buy Cigarette Volume 1 and Cigarette Volume 2. Yeah, you just have to go under Documentaries tab if you want to get Volume 1. And it says the Secret Rite series there. You just click on Secret Rite Volume 1, and there's a button there to buy the disc. So there you go. You can buy Volume 1 and Volume 2. We also have all kinds of packages for Volume 2. If you still haven't gotten your DVDs or Blu-rays that you ordered, or just sit tight. They will be there very soon. They're on their way, so just be patient. Thank you so much for everybody being patient with that. I'll have a limited opportunities to be able to get to the post office, so sometimes they go out later than I want them to, but they get there eventually. Just be patient. We have all kinds of packages up there for Cigarette Volume 2 where you can get the Blu-rays, you can get the DVDs. We have research packs where you can get soundtrack discs, data DVD, all kinds of packages up there. We also have a donate button at the site if you want to use that. That can put in any amount you want to donate to our work so we can have some in our war chest to be able to do the things we need to do. For those of you that are new listeners and you haven't supported our work yet, please do so. First of all, then, it must be understood that the astral plane has 7 subdivisions, each of which has its corresponding degree of materiality and its corresponding condition of matter. This is scenery now. Scenery inside of the astral plane is what they're talking about here. Now, numbering these from the highest and least material downwards, we find that they naturally fall into 3 classes. Division 1 and 2 and 3 forming one such class, and 4 and 5 and 6 another. While the 7th and lowest of all stands alone. The difference between the matter of one of these classes and the liquid, while the difference between the matter of the subdivisions of a class would rather resemble that between 2 kinds of solids, such as, say, steel and sand. Putting aside for the moment the 7th, we may say that divisions 4, 5, and 6 of the astral plane have, for their background, the physical world we live in and all its familiar accessories. Life on the 6th division is simply our ordinary life on this earth, minus the physical body and its necessities. While as it ascends through the 5th and 4th divisions, it becomes less and less material, and is more and more withdrawn from our lower world and its interests. The scenery of these lower divisions, then, is that of the earth as we know it, but it's also very much more. For when looked at from this different standpoint with the assistance of the astral senses, even purely physical objects present a very different appearance. As has already been mentioned, they are seen by one whose eyes are fully open, not as usual from one point of view, but from all sides at once. An idea in itself sufficiently confusing. And when we add to this that every particle in the interior of a solid body is as fully and clearly visible as those on the outside, it will be comprehended that under such conditions, even the most familiar objects may at first be totally unrecognizable. Yet a moment's consideration... See, it keeps turning back on me. Sorry about that. Yet a moment's consideration will show that such vision approximates much more closely to true perception than does physical sight. Looked at on the astral plane, for example, the sides of a glass cube would all appear equal as they really are, while on the physical plane, we see the further side in perspective. That is, it appears smaller than the nearer side, which is, of course, a mere illusion. It is this characteristic of astral vision which has led to it sometimes being spoken of as sight in the fourth dimension, a very suggestive and expressive phase. But in addition to these possible sources of error, matters are further complicated by the fact that astral sight cognizes forms of matter which, while still purely physical, are nevertheless invisible under ordinary conditions. Such, for example, are the particles composing the atmosphere. All the various emanations which are always being given out by everything that has life are also four grades of a still finer order of physical matter, which, for want of more distinctive names, must all be described as etheric, like etherical energy barrier around the Earth, Van Allen radiation belts, designed to keep us entrapped here on this prison planet by some ancient race who didn't want us to escape. The latter form of any kind of system by themselves freely interpenetrating all other physical matter. And the investigation of their vibrations and the manner in which various higher forces affect them would in itself constitute a vast field of deeply interesting study for any man of science who possessed the requisite sight for its examination. Even when our imagination has fully grasped all that is comprehended in what has already been said, we do not yet understand half the complexity of the problem. For besides all these new forms of physical matter, we have to deal with the still more numerous and perplexing subdivisions of astral matter. We must note first that every material object, even particles, has its astral counterpart, and this counterpart is itself not a simple body, but is usually extremely complex, being composed of various kinds of astral matter. In addition to this, each living creature is surrounded with an atmosphere of its own, usually called its aura. And in the case of human beings, this aura forms of itself a very fascinating branch of study. It is seen as an oval mass of luminous mist of highly complex structure, and from its shape has sometimes been called the auric egg. Theosophical readers will hear with pleasure that even at the early stage of this development, at which the pupil begins to acquire this astral sight, he is able to assure himself by direct observation of the accuracy of the teaching given through our great founder, Madame Blavatsky. On the subject of some, at least, of the seven principles of man, in regarding his fellow man, he no longer sees only his outer appearance. Exactly coextensive with that physical body, he clearly distinguishes the etheric double, which in theosophical literature has usually been called the linga sharia, while the hiva, as it absorbed and specialized into the prana, as it circulates in rosy light throughout the body, as it eventually radiates from the healthy person in its altered form, is also perfectly obvious. Most brilliant and most easily seen of all, perhaps, though belonging to a quite different order of matter, the astral is the chemic aura, which expresses by its vivid and ever-changing flashes of color the different desires which sweep across the man's mind from moment to moment. This is the true astral body. Behind that, and consisting of a finer grade of matter, that of the rupa levels of Devakian lines, the devachanic body or aura of the lower manas, whose colors changing only by slow degrees as the man lives his life, show the disposition and character of the personality, while still higher and infinitely more beautiful, whereat all clearly developed is the living light of the krana shirara, the aura or vehicle of the higher manas, which shows the stage of development of the real ego and its passage from birth to birth. But to see these, the pupil must have developed something more than mere astral vision. It will save the student much trouble if he learns at once to regard these auras,
not as mere emanations, but as the actual manifestation of the ego on their respective planes. If he understands that it is the auric egg which is the real man, not the physical body which on this plane crystallizes in the middle of it. So long as the reincarnating ego remains upon the plane which is his true home in the Arupa levels of the Devakin, the body which he inhabits is the Karana Shiara. But when he descends into the Rupa levels, he must, in order to be able to function upon them, clothe himself in their matter. And that's talked about in all kinds of ancient texts. They call it the etherical temple garment. Manly P. Hall talks about that in the Secret Teaching of All Ages, about, you know, when the adept goes for his final training, he goes, you know, in this chamber that's located inside of the Great Sphinx, and he has to wear this etherical temple garment. That was talked about by Thoth in the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, about going into the halls of Amenti and being in clothing yourself with this this garment that basically doesn't allow the pure radiant light of the halls of Amenti to rip through your fragile little meat suit. So again, that that etherical garment is always there. It's also there, ever present in stuff where people are going through stargates. I did an interview with William Henry about a year ago. It's on YouTube, and there's some great stuff that we get into in there about, you know, the fiery furnace, and it's always some garment that allows them to travel through this stargate so that they're not, you know, burned up or something by the process. It's always interesting that you see that. When he descends into the Rupa levels, he must, in order to be able to function upon them, clothe himself in their matter. And the matter that he thus attracts to himself furnishes his devachanic or mind body. Similarly, transcending into the astral plane, he forms his astral or kamic body out of its matter, though of course still retaining all the other bodies. And on his still further descent to this lowest plane of all, the physical body is formed in the midst of the auric egg, which thus contains the entire man. Fuller accounts of these auras will be found in transaction number 18 of the London Lodge and in a recent article of mine in The Theosophist. But enough has been said here to show that as they all occupy the same space, which, by the way, they share also with the physical health aura, the finer interpenetrating the grosser. It needs careful study and much practice to enable the neophyte to distinguish clearly at a glance the one from the other. Nevertheless, the human aura, or more usually some part of it, only is not infrequently one of the first purely astral objects seen by the untrained, though in such a case its indications are naturally very likely to be misunderstood. Yeah, because that's something, you know, anybody can really see if you really want to. I've seen people's auras all the time, but sometimes you don't see them because people are just so, you know, wound up and programmed. Though the kamic aura, from the brilliancy of its flashes of color, may often be more conspicuous, the nerve ether and the etheric double are really of a much denser order of matter. Being, strictly speaking, within the limits of the physical plane, though invisible to ordinary sight, it has been the custom in theosophical literature to describe the Linga Sharia as the astral counterpart of the human body. The word astral having been usually applied to everything beyond the cognition of our physical senses. As closer investigation enables us to be more precise in the use of our terms, however, we find ourselves compelled to admit much of this invisible matter as purely physical, and therefore to define the Linga Sharia no longer as the astral, but as the etheric double. This seems an appropriate name for it, since it consists of various grades of that matter which scientists call ether. Though this proves, on examination, not to be a separate substance, as has been generally supposed, but a condition of finer subdivisions than the gaseous to which any kind of physical matter may be reduced by the application of the appropriate forces. The name etheric double will therefore be used in the future in theosophic writings instead of Linga Sharia. And this change will not only give us the advantage of an English name, which is clearly indicative of the character of the body to which it is applied, but will also relieve us from the frequent misunderstandings which have arisen from the fact that an entirely different signification is attached in all of the Oriental books to the names that we have hitherto been using. It must not, however, be supposed that in making this alteration in nomenclature that we are in any way putting forward a new conception. We are simply altering for the sake of a greater accuracy the labels previously attached to certain facts in nature. If we examine with psychic faculty the body of a newly born child, we shall find it permeated not only by astral matter of every degree of density, but also by the several grades of etheric matter. And if we take the trouble to trace these inner bodies backwards to their origin, we find that it is of the latter that the etheric double, the mold upon which the physical body is built. It is formed by the agents of the lords of karma. While the astral matter has been gathered together by the descending ego, not of course consciously, but automatically, as he passes through the astral plane. Into the composition of the etheric double must enter something of all the different grades of etheric matter, for their proportions may vary greatly and are determined by several factors such as the race, sub-race, and type of a man, as well as his individual karma. When it is remembered that these four subdivisions of matter are made up of numerous combinations, which in their turn form aggregations that enter into the composition of the atom of the so-called element of the chemist, it will also be seen that this second principle of man is highly complex, and the number of its possible variations practically infinite. So that, however complicated and unusual a man's karma may be, the Lipika are able to give a mold in accordance with which a body exactly suiting it can be formed. One other point deserves mention in connection with the appearance of physical matter when looked at from the astral plane. And that is that the astral vision possesses the power of magnifying at will the minutest physical particle to any desired size as though by a microscope. Though its magnifying power is enormously greater than that of any microscope ever made or ever likely to be made, the hypothetical molecule and atom postulated by science are therefore visible realities to the occult student, though the latter recognizes them as much more complex in their nature than the scientific man has yet to be discovered. Here again is a vast field of study of absorbing interest to which a whole volume might readily be devoted. And a scientific investigator who should acquire his astral sight in perfection would not only find his experiments with ordinary and known phenomena immensely facilitated, but would also see stretching before him entirely new vistas of knowledge, needing more than a few lifetimes for their thorough examination. For example, one curious and very beautiful novelty brought to his notice by the development of his vision would be the existence of other and entirely different colors beyond the limits of the ordinarily visible spectrum. The ultra-red and ultraviolet rays, which science has discovered by other means, being plainly perceptible to astral light. Being plainly perceptible to astral sight. And you can see these different colors and these different astral planes, and I know that that's something that under the influence of certain hallucinogenic substances you experience as well. Few untrained persons on that plane, whether living or dead, see things as they really are until after very long experience. Even those who do see fully are often too dazed and confused to understand or remember, and among the very small minority who both see and remember, there are hardly any who can translate the recollection into language on our lower plane. Many untrained psychics never examine their vision scientifically at all. They simply obtain an impression which may be quite correct, but also may be half false or even wholly misleading. Yeah, I know people who, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes people I know, I know people who say they channel stuff, But sometimes I wonder if it's, you know, if it is they're indeed channeling something or if it's just their mind working. And, you know, sometimes you take things that these things say and you take them one way, but it may be saying it a completely different other if you're not trained on how to be able to interpret visions that you see in other realms and dimensions and stuff like that. All the more probable does the latter hypothesis become when we take into consideration the frequent tricks played by sportive Denzians of the other world, against which the untrained person is absolutely defenseless. It must also be remembered that the regular inhabitant of the astral plane, whether he be human or elemental, is under ordinary circumstances conscious only of the objects of that plane, physical matter being to him as entirely invisible as is astral matter to the majority of mankind. Since, as before remarked, every physical object has its astral counterpart, which would be visible to him, it may be thought that the distinction is a trivial one. Yet it is an essential part of the symmetrical conception of the subject. If, however, an astral entity constantly works through a medium, these finer astral senses may gradually be so coarsened as to become insensible to the higher grades of matter on their own plane, and to include in their purview the physical world as we see it instead, but only the trained visitor from this life, who is fully conscious on both planes, can depend upon seeing both clearly and simultaneously. Be it understood, then, that the complexity exists, and that only when it is fully perceived and scientifically unraveled is there perfect security against deception or mistake. For the seventh or lowest subdivision of the astral plane, also this physical world of ours may be said to be the background, though what is seen is only a distorted and partial view of it, since all that is light and good and beautiful seems invisible. It was thus described 4,000 years ago in the Egyptian papyrus of the scribe Ani. What matter of place is this unto which I have come? It hath no water, it hath no air. It is deep, unfathomable, it is black as the blackest night, and men wonder helplessly about it therein. In it a man may not live in quietness of heart. For the unfortunate entity on that level, it is indeed true that all the earth is full of darkness and cruel habitations. But it is darkness which radiates from within himself and causes his existence to be passed in a perpetual night of evil, of horror, a very real hell, though, like all other hells, entirely of man's own creation. Most students find the investigations of this section an extremely unpleasant task, for there appears to be a sense of density and gross materiality about it, which is indescribably loathsome to the liberated astral body, causing it the sense of pushing its way through some black, vicious fluid, while the inhabitants and influences encountered there are usually exceedingly undesirable. The first, second, and third subdivisions seem much further removed from the physical world and correspondingly less material. Entities inhabiting these levels lose sight of the earth and its belongings. They're usually deeply self-absorbed and, to a large extent, create their own surroundings. Though these are not purely subjective, as in Devakin, but, on the contrary, sufficiently objective to be perceptible to other entities and also to clairvoyant vision. This region is beyond doubt the Summerland, of which we hear so much at spiritualistic seances, and the entities who descend from there from and describe it are probably often speaking the truth, as far as their knowledge extends. It is on these planes that spirits call into temporary existence their houses, schools, and cities. For these objects are often real enough for the time, though to a clearer sight they may sometimes be pitifully unlike what their delighted creators suppose them to be. Nevertheless, many of the imaginations that take form there are of real, though temporary, beauty. And a visitor who knew of nothing higher might wander contentedly enough among forests and mountains, lovely lakes and pleasant flower gardens, or might even construct such surroundings to suit his own fancies. It may be said in passing that communication is limited on the astral plane by the knowledge of the entity, just as it is here. While a person able to function freely on that plane can communicate with any of the human entities there present more readily and rapidly than on Earth by means of mental impressions, the inhabitants themselves do not usually seem able to exercise this power, but appear to be restricted by limitations similar to those that prevail on Earth, though perhaps less rigid. The result of this is that they are found associating here in groups drawn together by common sympathies, beliefs, and language. An account of the scenery of the astral plane would be incomplete without mention of what are commonly called the records of the astral light, the photographic representation of all that has ever happened. These records are really and permanently impressed upon that higher medium called the Akasha. Right, the Akashic records. And are only reflected in a more or less spasmodic manner in the astral light. So that one whose power of vision does not rise above this plane will be likely to obtain only occasional and disconnected pictures of the past instead of a coherent narrative. But nevertheless, pictures of all kinds of past events are constantly being reproduced on the astral plane and form an important part of the surroundings of the investigator there. So that's the end of that part. The scenery, next time we'll get into the inhabitants, and this will get into the various entities and different things that inhabit the astral plane. This is fascinating stuff. It's always interesting to get into the stuff that that they believe in, you know. And when you study theosophy and you look at the history of it and stuff, it is some of this ancient teaching that go back to the Anunnaki, and it's stuff that they, you know, kind of an amalgamation of all the world's religions and stuff that they have wanted kept in secret. And that's why that Hitler was looking for it. That's why they've created this bastardized version of American theosophy where everything's changed and, you know, takes on different meanings. It's just unbelievable stuff. Anyway, that's going to do it for us tonight. TheGlobalReality.com is our website. Tomorrow's our last day of our fundraiser for the month to pay the bills, so please help us reach that goal there if you can. We hadn't got much in this week, so help out the cause if you can, folks. That's all I got to say about that. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. We'll see you next time. You have a great one. Take care.